We're doing the Nevi Yeshaya. We have a few new faces, so we'll quickly reintroduce. Yeshaya was probably the most poetic prophet. Yeshaya was a descendant from the Davidic dynasty. His grandfather was the king of Judea. His uncle, Amoz, was the following king of Judea. So his uncle was king, and then his cousin was king, and then his cousin's son was king. Meaning the Davidic dynasty ran from his grandfather through his uncle, not through his father. So Yeshaya's father, Amatziah, was a prophet, and Yeshaya himself was a prophet. Yeshaya was ultimately murdered by his own grandson because his daughter married his cousin's son, right? So it's a little bit more generations, but his uncle was Amatziah. And then we have Uzziah, Yotam, Ahaz, Yechizkiyahu. So it was his cousin's great-grandson who married his daughter. And then they had a son, the following king of Judea, called Menashe. And Menashe, who was his grandson, and also his son-in-law was actually his cousin's great-grandson, right? So his grandson Menashe ultimately murders him, his grandson who was the king of Judea. Yeshaya gives us prophecies in the first half of the book, prophesizing about the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. Yeshaya lived about a century and a half before the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. And then the end of the book of Yeshaya, which we are up to, describes the redemption. And at times, it's not clear whether Yeshaya is talking about the future redemption, which we are still anticipating. As we read after Tisha B'Av, seven prophecies from Yeshaya describing the coming redemption, what we call the Shiva Din Chemta. Or is Yeshaya describing the redemption, which is about to happen, a century and a half, two centuries later, the redemption from the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. With the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, you had tens of thousands of Jews sold into slavery. Following that, you had the Persian Empire overtaking the Babylonian Empire, freeing the Jews from slavery and giving them license to return to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. We learned a few weeks ago that the Navi Yeshaya did something unusual. He identifies by name, two centuries earlier, he identifies by name that the king Koresh is going to be the one to send the Jews back to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. Koresh is in fact the son of Esther. We read the story of Esther on Purim. She marries Ahasuerus, as we know, and they have a son, Koresh. That son, Koresh, is the one that ultimately gives us license to rebuild the Second Temple. Again, we're skipping many details, right? But in a nutshell, the Navi Yeshaya is describing the disappointment that he knows will happen with Koresh. Koresh knows that his whole kingdom is thanks to the Jews, because when there was the pivotal battle between Babylonians and the Persian Mede Empire, the Persian Medes lost, and they were ready to give up. And it was that night that Belshazzar, the Babylonian king, thought he was invincible. The 70 years that he thought would be the demise of his empire had just come. And he thought to himself, look at that. The Navi, the prophet, had described that my empire would last for 70 years. And the 70 years are up. And I just won the most major battle. The greatest enemy, the Persian Mede Empire, couldn't hurt me. I was successful in quelling that rebellion. So Belshazzar takes out that night the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash, it is Pesach, and in his celebration, he takes out those vessels to celebrate with his officers, with his army, and he drinks 1,000 cups of wine, he's having a ball. And in the middle of the party, a hand appears and starts writing on the wall, and they summon Daniel, and Daniel interprets the writing on the wall that the kingdom is about to be finished, he will lose to the Persian Empire. word gets out to the Persians that this miracle happened and they're supposed to win. And that night, one of the servants of Belshazzar says, Daniel is a man of truth. If Daniel says this is going to happen, it's going to happen. And so he goes and kills, he assassinates Belshazzar and brings his head to the Persian Medes. And the Persian Medes attack that night and win and take over the Babylonian Empire and free the Jewish slaves. One of the declarations upon winning is that the Jewish slaves are free. So the Persians know that they owe a lot to the Jews because they were ready to give up the war. It was thanks to the God of the Jews, right, that they won. It was thanks to Daniel that they came back and fought. And so where we're holding in the Navi Yeshayah is that the Navi is speaking about Koresh and how Koresh owes us. Koresh was supposed to play an active role in the rebuilding of the second Beit HaMikdash, and instead, Koresh stays behind in Persia and says, Jews, you can go, have a good time. I'll support you. But make sure when you build it, he leaves instruction to stick in wood under the building of stone so that if the Jews ever rebelled, the Persians could always burn down their fortification. So Koresh does things in an inappropriate way. He's not fully behind the Jews. Just before we continue, I kept mentioning questions that have surfaced regarding the history of the Persians, Medes, and the Jews. I want to mention, I'm reading a book right now called Otsar HaVikuchim. Otsar HaVikuchim is an encyclopedia of debates that Jews had throughout our history, sometimes with other religions and sometimes just defending the Jewish religion. And within this compendium, there is a quote from a work by Josephus, which I must have missed, because I studied Josephus' writing and I don't remember reading this. And in the author's introduction and also in Josephus' writings, Josephus wrote a book called Neged Apion, Opposing Apion. And he wrote this because there was an Egyptian named Apion who was a vicious anti-Semite, and he invented his own tales about what the Jewish history was. He had a story about why we keep Shabbat. He had a story about how we left Egypt. He made up stories. And one of the things they quote there is that no one serious took him seriously. His strength was only in riling up the crowds against the Jews. He was a good orator, and he made up anti-Semitic stories. So he makes up a story that the Jews all broke out with leprosy in Egypt, and so the Egyptians chased them out of Egypt. But he got away with it, because he was preaching to ignorant farmers who were happy to learn about an enemy. In Rome, he tried to defame the Jews, and the emperor put him down. The emperor told him, you're full of nonsense. But his works were so disseminated that Josephus felt the need to write a work specifically disproving Apion's claims about the Jewish history. And he wrote a book called Opposing Apion. And one of the things we see both in Rabbi Eisenstein's introduction to the work and also in Josephus's writings is that historians played a lot of games with history. It was perfectly acceptable for the Mede historians to invent and to rewrite history. And that's one of the things that Josephus writes in the introduction to Opposing Apion. He writes, I want to deal with facts and not fiction, and I want to point out the fiction that was written. And among other things, he attacks the Mede, specifically the Persian Mede historians. So this was interesting to me because we have a big question mark in studying Jewish history, which we mentioned numerous times, that our sages say that there were 70 years between the destruction of the first temple and the rebuilding of the second temple. And many Persian Mede sources speak about it being over two centuries. That's a big gap, and that affects certain things about our calendar. So it was enlightening to me to see that a secular work, Josephus, who is, it's not even clear if he was Orthodox, it's questionable whether he was a Sadducee or he was an observant Jew. Nonetheless, Josephus writes, as he's writing to the emperor and also to other scholars, and it's well known that Josephus was also respected among scholars, and until today he's respected. And that's one of the things he writes, that it is a well-known fact that the Mede historians rewrote and adulterated their versions of history to suit what they thought the masses would enjoy hearing, and they changed facts either because they didn't know or because they just didn't want to write it the way it was. So that's just an interesting note. Yes, just a second. Avios, ready? Yeah.
If it was accepted that Koresh was the son of Esther, so luckily then he's Jewish, so he certainly has a natural reason. I mean, assuming that his mother was either the wife or the niece, either one of Mordechai, she would have given him some knowledge of where he came from, who he is, whatever. So,
depending on when he was born, he was a mamzer.
It was not a mamzer.
Not a mamzer?
No.
So I just want to know that.
Our sages say that Esther, so long as she was married to Mordechai, she inserted a tampon in modern terminology. The Gemara says, Mishameshet bimoch. She put in some kind of cloth inside that would act as a diaphragm to ensure that Ahasuerus's seed could not impregnate her. So that's after she divorced from Mordechai, then she allowed herself to become pregnant from Ahasuerus.
Someone...
But that's not our topic. We're supposed to do Yeshaya.
Right. The whole idea that, you know, the way it was whitewashed, maybe the way I learned it, that she's, you know, that she was the beast, makes it a lot easier in many respects. But I guess there was evidence to the contrary.
Yes.
So with Josephus, obviously, we know that refuting Epiphanes, what's his name?
Appion.
Appion's like,
yeah.
Okay. But obviously refuting Appion was important to him. I mean, is there any rhyme on why it was important to him? Because like you said, he's not necessarily religious.
He said he wants to save the face of his people. That Appion wrote such vile lies against the history of the Jews. He said he wants to establish our history. He wants to call spade a spade.
Okay.
We could have a whole class. We could have a whole series on Josephus. But let's try to do some. Thursday night. If it were yes or no, I would answer you. We're continuing with Yeshaya, what they call the 45th chapter, the 13th Pasuk. Hashem writes, the Navi Yeshaya writes, Anochi ha'irotihu v'tzedek v'chol derachav ayasher. Hashem says, I aroused Koresh b'tzedek with a sense of righteousness. What Koresh did was righteous. The Babylonian Empire deserved to be put down. I aroused him in righteousness, v'chol derachav ayasher, and I will support him so that his paths flow smoothly before him. Hu yivneh iri v'galuti yeshaleach. He will rebuild my city of Jerusalem. He will send my exile, my children who are in exile, back home. Lo v'mchir v'lo v'shochad. He won't charge a fee. He won't need to be bribed. Amar Adonai Tzevaot. So says Hashem, who controls the armies of the world. And that's what really happened. Because the enemies of the Jews in Israel tried to dissuade Koresh from what he was doing. And Koresh, on the contrary, looked for loopholes to support the Jews and refute their claims. Koresh did not need to be bribed. He was supportive. He said, go. So in that sense, Koresh lived up to expectations, but it wasn't enough. Ko amar Adonai. So says Hashem, Yegiha Mitzrayim uscharkush. Usvaim Anshei Mida. Hashem says, I will bring about the fall of Babylon, and I'll tell you another thing that will be a blessing in your days. I will take the toils of the Egyptians, the wares of the people of Cush, the wares of the people of Sivaim, and these people who are Anshei Mida, large people. Someone told me, I don't know if this is true, that anatomically, people in Africa are built larger. We had a guest from Africa, and they told us that this was a woman who was like 6'5". She can't duck as she entered the house. And in the conversation, she said, not the Jews. She said, the non-Jews in Africa are built much bigger than outside Africa. She said it might have to do with their diet, that they eat tremendous amounts of wild meat, lean meat. So the Pasuk describes what's going to happen is Sanherib, the king of the Assyrian Empire, will attack. He will conquer most of Judea, and then he will move on to conquer northern Africa, and then he will come back with the wealth of Egypt, right? He went southward from Israel into Egypt, and Cush, and Sivaim. I'm not sure what country is Sivaim. And then it says, Anshei Mida, into the territory of people who are unusually large, people who are Mida, of a large nature. So that's why I was thinking of what this lady from Africa told us. Alayich ya'avoru v'lach yiyu. She told us like this. She said, in Africa, I don't stand out. I'm 6'5". In Israel, I can find myself in a store and people come standing next to me and take their picture next to me. I'm just trying to shop. You guys can tell me. You guys are from Africa. I don't know. I'm telling you what she told me. I've never been to Africa.
Some tribes, we will tell you.
You will tell me?
In Africa, naturally, people from the West, the size of the region of Africa, the southern and the eastern Africa, they are moderate size.
Moderate size, yeah. Okay.
West Africa.
You're saying Western Africa is bigger. Okay.
Was that place the savannas?
I'm just trying to think. I don't know. I'm just trying to think if they would have reached West Africa. But who knows what it was like back then? I don't know. So the Navi describes how after Sanherib continues, he's conquered most of Judea. He continues into Africa and conquers large segments of Africa. Then he returns to Israel and loses. He has that fateful plague that Hashem causes his army to drop dead on the night of Pesach. And then after this plague that hits his army, he wobbles back to Syria. He has no forces to take back with him. Very few soldiers walked out alive. And all the wealth that they conquered from northern Africa ends up at the gates of Jerusalem. So that's what Hashem is describing here. Alayich yavoru v'lach yiyu. All that wealth will pass on to you. Acharayich yelechu bazikim yavoru. What happens is, they have all the people from Africa naked, standing in shackles, as they've laid siege on Jerusalem. The plague breaks out, and the Assyrian soldiers are dropping like flies. And so the Jews come out of the walls of Jerusalem, and now they have all these kingdoms of northern Africa standing in shackles, and now they have all the loot that the Assyrian Empire took from northern Africa. And that's what the Navi describes, Bazikim Yavoru. You will have the tribes of northern Africa led to you in shackles. Ve'elayich ishtachavu, elayich itpalalu. They will bow to you. They will beg you to release them of their bondage. They will ask you, so to speak, pray to you. Ach bach el. And they will say, we now know you have a God. Everyone else worships something. But we were standing here. We saw the Assyrian Empire. We saw them fall. We saw how at the gates of Jerusalem, you didn't stand a chance. As Sancheriv sends word to Chizkiyahu, the Judean king, he says to him, I'll give you the horsemen. You have enough soldiers to put on them? He says, every general of mine governs over more men than your whole army. How can you fight me? That's what he says as he lays siege on Jerusalem. He says, I'll give you the horses. You can't fight me. And that night, everything crumbles. And we have the miraculous victory. And so these people from northern Africa declare, Ach Bachel, there's a God among you. The Ein Od Efes Elohim. And there are none other than you, the God of Israel. And we will pick up here next week where Yeshayahu says one of his most famous lines. He says, at that point, Hashem will be revealed. But then Yeshayahu will turn to discuss the fact that Hashem can also be concealed. And that's where we will pick up Mezrat Hashem next week with Yeshayahu's famous words that Hashem is Kel Mistater. Hashem, throughout much of our history, has also been a hidden God. There are those moments where Hashem shines and shows us He's there. And then there's the rest of history where you have to look. Hashem is hidden. So we will pick up with that, Bezrat Hashem, next week.